and welcome to the Partners in FinCrime podcast in association with FSCom. My name's Evan McGugan.
And I'm Chris Vaughan.
In this podcast series, we'll be looking to discuss all things anti-financial crime.
We'll be deep diving into cutting-edge stories, as well as other interesting topics in the financial crime space. In this episode, we welcome a special guest to talk about the crypto asset travel rule.
Hey, Chris, how's it going?
Ireland, yeah, really good, thanks. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Any crack?
No, nothing to update you on particularly, I don't think. Starting to see a bit of sun come back into our lives. I had to bring back the weather talk because, you know, that's just what we do here, apparently, at the beginning of these episodes. But no, not much going on, mate. What about you?
Yeah, no, very little. It's unfortunately we've not got any holidays to speak of either at the start of this one, although we do have travel related stuff to speak about, so maybe that's the very tenuous link as to what we're hoping to talk about today. Also, we have a guest joining us today, Jason McKinney. Jason, welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me on today, lads, really appreciate it.
Great to have you.
Lovely to have you. Maybe for those who aren't familiar with you, Jason, would you mind giving us a brief introduction as to maybe who you are, what your story is?
Yeah, as you say, Evan, probably vast majority of your audience won't know who I am. Certainly not a Ray Blake caliber guest, but all the same, very happy to be here. So yeah, I'm Jason McKinney. I am the MLRO for Airwallex UK, which is a kind of mid-sized electronic money institution with a global footprint. As probably most people in the industry today, I got my start at FSCom, working with your with your good self and Philip Creed. So yeah, worked at FSCom, got a really good grounding in the industry. I came from a legal background, so that sort of aided in my kind of foray into this industry. Made the move to industry, worked with a authorized payment institution that also had a cryptocurrency license. I worked there for just about 2 years. Worked on some really cool products on the crypto world, worked in some really challenging DLT license applications in certain jurisdictions, and then made the move to Airwallex, and I've been there for about 18 months, assisting in some kind of global projects, namely, which is probably relevant to this discussion, Airwallex's foray into cryptocurrency and virtual asset service provision. So yeah, that's a little bit about me. Don't want to bore you too much with the details, but yeah.
I'd say you do yourself a disservice, Jason, as a esteemed ex-FSCom alumni. I'm sure a lot of people who are listening will be familiar with you.
Well, wouldn't count my chickens, as they say, but I'll take the compliment.
Yeah, good gaze. And yeah, I guess you very keenly touched on you know, why you're joining the podcast for this particular episode, which is it's going to be quite a crypto heavy one, and you'd be the perfect guy to help steer us and join us in the conversation. As I mentioned with my awful travel related reference at the start of this, we're going to be talking about the travel rule today, the crypto travel rule, which is due to come in force in the UK at the start of September 2023 through an amendment to the UK MLRs. I think the amendment has sort of been out there for some time, but it is going to be imposing some new requirements on crypto asset businesses. And this obviously comes probably about a month or so after the UK's JMLSG, the Joint Money Laundering Steering Group, released for consultation their proposed industry guidance on how crypto asset providers should comply with the new transfer of funds regulation. I think at the point of recording, we're currently on the 10th of August 2023, and the consultation's due to end in just a few weeks. So not a whole load of breathing room, but as you say, I think a lot of firms have been working on this for some time. So, gents, where do we start with this one? Maybe would either of you like to have a crack at setting the scene for us, perhaps? Maybe we can start off with what the travel rule is, where it's derived from, and maybe what it's intended to achieve.
I can maybe pick up there if that makes sense before we dive into it. Obviously, as you say, Evan, we discussed this a little bit, and we said we said we thought it'd be good to do a whole episode dedicated to the travel rule. And since it's, you know, really very much on its way now in the UK, I think it'd be good to dive back into this, which, as you can imagine, feels like Christmas for me, who never shuts up about crypto on this podcast. setting the scene, I suppose. Travel rule is, I suppose it's similar to wire transfer regulations for fiat. It's derives from originally recommendation 16 of FATF 40, and basically requires firms to send information along with a transaction that is that's sent out. So that can, there's various information depending on the situation, but that can be things like account holder or unique account information. It can be address, beneficiary, all these kinds of pieces of information that might need to travel along with a transaction. So of course, within the FATF 40, that's for transparency, for AML reasons, for KYC reasons, and making sure that we have that, as I said, transparency, I suppose, when it comes to transactions. So the travel rule then is crypto's counterpart, I suppose, for the same purpose. It was highly controversial when it was first proposed, and there's been a lot of, experts in the industry, first of all, pushing back against this. Initially, I think there was a lot of talk and consultation around whether this was the right thing for crypto, whether it even made sense. And I think we've sort of arrived at what you might call a compromise, let's say, in how this is actually being implemented, I suppose. A lot of people had called attention to things like unhosted wallets, this being quite a difficult, let's say, hurdle to get over, I suppose. We'll dive into all of this in a bit more detail as we go along, I think. But hopefully that sets the scene. Guys, I don't know if there's anything to add on top of that before we sort of get rolling.
No, quite happy with that. And then I guess from building on setting the scene perspective, who does it apply to in the UK?
As in, who will the travel rule apply to? It'll be VASPs. So every crypto asset business within the UK, crypto asset business, actually CB, is being used in the new JMLSG consultation, but VASP used in MLRs. VASP being used in MiCA, so, you know, not to muddy the waters with our definitions, but yeah, we sort of tangle ourselves up, I think, when it comes to crypto assets. But there you go. So that's who's this is going to apply to, I suppose.
We've got VASPs, we've got CASPs, we've got CBs, we've got CEPs, and now we've got CWPs, and I'm sure there'll be a few more acronyms to pop up before September 1st. So as you say, essentially the crypto asset version of the WTRs that we're all familiar with. I guess one of the difficulties then is, well, when you think about how WTRs work in TradFi, payment messaging, obviously all fairly homogenous. You sort of think about Swift message fields, you think about the information that comes with transfers, think about an IBAN, even how you can sort of break that down quite easily into its constituent parts. So country, bank, branch, account number, all this good stuff doesn't really exist with a virtual asset address. So how are firms meant to talk to each other, so to speak? Jason, do you have any idea how this is meant to work? The million-dollar question.
Yeah, I don't think anybody has a concrete idea of how this is supposed to work. But you obviously have, what usually happens is what you typically have when something like this comes up is your third-party providers, right? And there's various different protocols from which you can send the information through on. So what the really sort of, I think the thing we have to remember here is that even when the wire transfer regulations were brought into force, there was a sort of similar, how's this going to work? It took maybe a decade for SWIFT to emerge as the leading method of sending that required information. So we sort of are faced with a similar situation here. So we have open closed protocols that can be used, open source protocols that can be used to send the information. We have closed source, which is the crypto working group, formerly known as the US crypto working group. That's been recently expanded to include non-US domiciled crypto businesses. And then you as always, you have some commercial solutions as well, commercial protocols such as kind of Verify Fast. How that's going to work in a practical sense is kind of for the firms to decide, and it really is going to be dictated by a virtual asset service provider's business model, its customer type, its geography, its payment geography as well. So every sort of recommendation I'm seeing, both from sort of the industry and the working groups, is that the best thing to do at the minute is introduce kind of a protocol agnostic solution. So essentially, don't hedge your bets on one protocol. Have a solution that can kind of account for them all. And I think whilst this sort of embeds itself, developed not just in the UK, but across kind of the globe, you are going to see these different protocols emerging, some refining, some merging, some, and of course, some falling away. It's something that I think will be very interesting to monitor. But essentially, there is protocols out there that firms can use. There is solutions out there that firms can use. But as we used to say on audits, there's no such thing as a silver bullet. So it really just depends on the firm's own profile, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. That's super helpful. Maybe if we just say what these protocols do as well, that might be helpful, because obviously, you know, we can go to third parties for this, but I think broadly what we're saying is that the requirements within the travel rule are really to make sure that the correct information that's required by the new amendment to the MLRs is being carried along with the transaction in cases in which it's required. So first of all, it's about bundling that information into a transferable, sort of piece of data that can be sent to a counterparty firm. And as Jason's just alluded to there, it's also about understanding whether the counterparty firm has the infrastructure and the ability to be able to, for the protocols to talk to each other and to be able to digest that information. One key thing which we can, I don't know if maybe I'm stepping into this too early, but one key thing to think about is, what if the information that is being sent doesn't match the information on the other end when it's been received? And that's obviously a whole part of this which opens up a veritable can of worms when it comes to actually dealing with incoming transactions. We've mentioned this before on this podcast, but crypto asset transactions cannot be stopped. They hit crypto asset addresses. It's just not part of the technology to be able to reject them. So it's about what you do after that point, really, and how to deal with that, which is definitely going to be a burden in some instances. It's certainly an operational burden of some variety on firms to learn how to deal with that. Yeah, maybe I'm getting a bit ahead of myself there anyway, but that's roughly speaking what the purpose of a third party provider would be, as you know, these are known as protocols, I guess, to send this information in a compliant way. Maybe we could step into what the actual requirements are of what needs to be done. I mean, we don't need to go through line by line of the regulation necessarily, but it might be good to, at a high level, just talk about what needs to be done, if that makes sense.
Yep, definitely. So I guess at quite a high level, the CB, to use that acronym in this case of the originator, essentially has to ensure that there is specific information in whatever way they manage to do that through the protocols and so on, accompanies that ultimate transfer. So very similar to the WTRs, you're talking about the name of the originator, the name of the beneficiary, the sort of registered underlying name of that originator or beneficiary as well, if it's a legal entity, and then also account numbers of those originators and beneficiaries. I know there's obviously carve-outs to this as well, and talk on de minimis thresholds. So please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it's transfers over 1,000 euro equivalent that sort of fall into this in the UK. So in a similar sort of way that you can avail of reduced information requirements in the WTRs, if you're conducting a transfer which is under 1,000 euro and both legs of that transaction are in the UK, and again, you're happy with the interchange between the two CBs, the protocols all match up, you can send that reduced information. If it's above that, you have to give the full information. And then also when you sort of have one leg of that transfer out of the UK as well, for example, in a jurisdiction like the EU, which isn't expected to bring the travel rule in until 2024 or even further afield, that the expectation is that you would have fuller information on that. So I guess that's sort of the guts of the requirement. And similarly, also, there's going to be requirements set out to identify that counterparty to the transaction. So you'd be talking about CBs versus unhosted wallets. What do you do if you get an inbound transaction from an unhosted wallet, and so on? So maybe that's another avenue to go down. And I think we are jumping about a bit here on this topic because it's so big. But yeah, if you've got CB to CB, you have to do this. What happens if it's funds inbound from an unhosted wallet?
So yeah, the unhosted wallet piece, I think maybe one thing, probably just call out that it's kind of is, even if it's a domestic transfer, I think, you know, less than €1,000 equivalent, there's questions about how firms are going to calculate that €1,000 equivalency, if there's trading pairs, if there's not trading pairs. It's something that firms need to consider also. But I think one thing I'd just like to call out before we jump into the host of wallet space is probably, even if the transfer is UK to UK and it's less than €1,000, and you, as a FASB, you send reduced information as the originator, the beneficiary FASB can then request that those additional facts as well. And that's something firms probably need to be aware of, particularly in, as we know, it's a very kind of, with banking relationships are a bit tenuous with the crypto industry at the minute. That could be potentially something we see happening quite a lot, even with intra-UK transfers. So just wanted to get that little nugget out there, as it was burning a hole in my head.
But before you move on, I was going to say it's actually a really good point to make too, which is transfers below that threshold still have to have information going with them, right? Yeah. It's just reduced. So it's like name and account number versus the whole shebang. So this is probably an outlandish example, but if you're a CB who somehow limited their outbounds and inbound payments to less than €1,000, you'd still have to go and implement all this. So yeah, still very much just reduced, and you should very much expect and have your information ready to be able to be provided if you are asked. So yeah, very good point to make.
Yeah, so no, it's a really good point that the minimum standard, like if we compare it with, first, you know, they say at Gibraltar, who, you know, whilst is obviously grey listed at the moment, but has had probably one of the more mature authorization schemes in place for DLT businesses. They introduced the travel rule in, I believe it was 2022 or 21, and their threshold is only transactions over €1,000, or, well, at the time when I was reading the legislation, it was transactions over €1,000. They did state that could change with a government order in the future date, but I'm not sure if that's occurred yet. But yeah, in the UK, every crypto transaction must be accompanied by a certain level of information.
Yeah, absolutely. Super helpful, I think, that unpacking the de minimis, let's say, because as you say, information still needs to travel along with the transaction, but it's, let's say, the standard amount of information as opposed to the enhanced information, which would be required by a €1,000 plus. And Jason, you really, you know, right to pick out there, how do you decide what's an €1,000 equivalent? It sounds easy enough to say, okay, it's the equivalent value in the currency at the time, but that becomes much more difficult when you really break down into what that means, who's deciding that currency pairs, as you said, Jason, all of that comes into it. So there's so many parts of this that, while on the face of it seems simple, once you really think about putting it in place, practically speaking, you can, you know, the sort of the complexities really start to pop up. And these are things that firms are going to have considered in detail before they really get rolling with this, I think. Many firms have already started this process, and some are currently live with sort of travel rule compliance, which is great. I just think it's one of those things that the complexities need to be sort of played out live in the industry rather than just thinking about how we're going to do this theoretically. You need to do it practically as well. One of the things we've talked about that might be worth going back to is, so, you know, we understand we need to send this information over to to a beneficiary institution. What happens in cases where we're dealing with unhosted wallets? So it's not a VASP to a VASP or a CB to a CB, but an unhosted wallet perhaps to, you know, a VASP. Before you guys jump into that, just want to clarify so that we sort of close the loop nicely. Unhosted wallet, by that we mean simply someone who holds their own private keys and isn't relying on a third party to hold custody of their crypto assets. Thoughts there, guys?
Yeah, no worries. So yeah, I think unhosted wallets have been sort of the bane of regulators and FATF guidance for some years now. We've seen proposals in the US from FinCEN that were subsequently tabled about any transactions with unhosted wallets will have to be reported to FinCEN above a certain threshold, etc. Singapore have a similar sort of approach to unhosted wallets, but it purely dealing in the UK. So the JMSG guidance sets it out as firms have to take a risk-based approach when dealing with unhosted wallets. Now, the guidance says in certain situations where the risks of money laundering, terrorist financing, proliferation financing, all that good stuff are higher, then firms may consider requesting this information, the originator and beneficiary information. How do they do that with an unhosted wallet is probably one of the major sort of operational questions. We have, you know, micro deposits within a certain time frame can be used to verify wallet ownership, cryptographically signing the wallet, but then it's resource intensive, right? So I think this is probably one of the major questions that virtual asset service providers will have to tackle in this, is really setting out their risk appetite, their policies, their procedures, and their kind of requests for information processes if they have a large portion of kind of self-custody or cold storage deposits from their customers.
So I know it obviously talks about sort of verifying that control through the micro deposits and signatures and such, as you say, and ascertaining source of funds too. I guess that logical knock on then is what happens if you can't manage that? What happens if you're not able to meet that threshold? What should the firm do then?
Well, that's the difficult question, isn't it? It's
gonna be a lot of difficult questions today.
yeah, probably picked the wrong topic to come on, but but no. So like this is Chris has pointed it out a few times at the top of this podcast and subsequent podcasts, that you can't stop an incoming crypto transaction, right? Your travel rule compliance is one facet of your wider kind of financial crime controls. You're going to have your blockchain analytics, cold storage. Is your blockchain tool going to give you a really good insight into that? Certain circumstances, maybe. All our times, maybe not. In the instance where a firm just can't get comfortable with the risk, they're going to have to develop policies and procedures for returning those virtual assets. In this instance, there's obviously going to be gas fees involved. There's going to be certain sort of, you know, value changes with the volatility of certain virtual assets, and that's really where I think the terms and conditions of a firm's contract with their customers are going to need to be examined. Right, they're going to need to sort of look at them and say, does the customer fully understand what they're signing up for here? Have we made it clear that if you're transacting with self-hosted wallets, there's a risk that this could happen, you could incur costs. Is it right to pass those costs on to the customers? You know, we've seen a big drive this year with the FCA on consumer duty. I know it doesn't necessarily apply to the AML registered virtual asset service providers, but it is still something that firms should consider with the evolving regulatory landscape. So yeah, if you can't get comfortable, you have to devise a policy, a procedure, and a method for returning funds in an effective manner that doesn't cause you undue stress, but also doesn't cause the customer undue stress. But if there's also a SAR, if there's a suspicious activity report that has to happen, you know, that investigation should be complete, then all returns should be in line with any sort of tipping off obligations on their pocket as well.
Yeah, it's pretty serious change to what you generally think of when it comes to crypto, which is instantaneous, immutable. And maybe if you were starting a VASP tomorrow, you could sort of put these structures in place. But to change the sort of operating model in that regard, you can see how it's been such a bit of business for people to get ready. And I guess sort of, I'm not sure we really touched on it that much earlier either, but where information is missing from the communication as part of the travel rule, again, very similar situation. You're going to have to hold that in some regard and then do the outreach and then manage it in that same way you've described. So huge change from a sort of payment flow process.
Massive, yeah, absolutely massive change. I think if you were to take Satoshi's white paper, it probably wouldn't align with the original sort of idea of Bitcoin and virtual assets as a whole. But yeah, like as you say, the guidance specifically states that the information should be sent before the transfer is made or alongside the transfer. So it's that sort of perception of, okay, we've received this transaction from firm A for the benefit of our customer B. We haven't got all the information, therefore we can't make those funds available to that customer until such times as we've satisfied that regulatory obligation. And that's very resource intensive, right, for firms. And having that sort of operational compliance operation staff in place, or even really effective tools, well, or in-house built or third party purchased, is really going to be a key consideration here. And there's also, you know, if you're requesting information out, you're going to have internal SLAs on how long you wait for that before you revert the transaction. And as we just touched on there, it's not very easy to revert a crypto transaction. And yeah, so it's all those sort of considerations that firms have to take, as you say. And it's a massive uplift in policy procedure, you know, even upskilling staff as well, right? You know, new systems, new controls, you know, I'm sure it's not going to be an absolute smooth process, but it's something that firms just have to do.
Yeah, 100%. I think what's interesting there as well is that it's sort of something which I'll say I've been, let's say, or many people within the AML space have been calling for in crypto for a long time, which is in terms of risk management, actually having functionality to your customer wallets to be able to freeze funds or at least have cooldown periods in which you're actually able to do an assessment of risk. Because quite often, particularly when you know, firms just first enter in this space, customers could quickly deposit funds and then transfer out almost immediately. We're seeing that particularly problematically with dark market transfers, sanctions, things that your blockchain providers, your blockchain monitoring providers are there for, you know, to find. But you know, what use is it if the transaction's already gone, sort of thing? You weren't able to stop that happening. You just identified it later on. Now we're actually, you know, that's not just best practice anymore, I suppose, is what I'm saying. It's not just, this is what we would like to see as a best practice piece. This is, we're going to have to do this because otherwise we're actually not going to, you know, we're going to be non-compliant with the travel rule. So I think that's a really important piece, and it all sort of fits together from an AML perspective nicely, not just from that informational standpoint, but also just from that risk management standpoint. It's interesting. I think this is one thing that I sort of wanted to touch on as well, is are firms becoming more and more mandated, let's say, to actually have blockchain monitoring in place and to use a third party or a provider for that? Because, you know, when some of the first guidance around, let's say, VA and VASP guidance from FATF came out, there was still very much within the text a position that was, blockchain monitoring might be useful in certain circumstances with certain customers, with certain kinds of relationships or products and services. And it was really, the onus was on the firm itself to understand if it was going to be necessary in whatever case. Do we think that in order to be able to even make a risk assessment, do it, you know, a firm's just going to be forced to do that. Most of them have already done it, you know, to be honest, obviously. But you see where I'm going in sort of my questioning there. It's almost like mandating a provider because firms are not really going to be able to do this on their own and they don't have the resources for it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does, Chris. I think it's an excellent point as well. I think I sort of touched on it earlier. Like this, the travel rule is just one facet. If it's, you know, if you purchase or you build, the guidance very clearly states that this has to be supplemented by, you know, blockchain analytics, and it also has to be supplemented by sanction screening tools. And I think, yeah, if you compare it with, say, the guidance on transaction monitoring for fiat, you know, it's very technology neutral. Whereas in this instance, I think, as you say, there really is a move towards of that mandating of a blockchain analytics tool. There's a lot of great providers out there, but it is something that is probably, I would say, an industry first in this scenario. If a cryptocurrency firm didn't have a blockchain analytics tool, it would be very difficult for them to kind of justify risk management, unless their product offering, of course, was really sort of, you know, they could justify it through that instance. But with just the nature of crypto, I would imagine going for registrations, going for authorizations through MiCA in the future, blockchain analytics is going to be a major pillar in what these regulators look at. And we sort of see this with the guidance that's been released.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really exactly right. That's basically, you know, what I was pushing towards there, I suppose. You know, as you say, you could quite easily, I think, do and have the ability and outfit your compliance team to be able to do transaction monitoring perfectly compliantly in the fiat space. But it just seems more and more like it's completely not possible for crypto anymore. And yeah, I think that's that. Like you said, there's tons of providers out there who all, you know, seem to be, you know, excellent tools for certain. But it is strange that we're saying, right, this is just expected. You have to have this third party relationship, and you're just going to have to include it as sort of an operational outlay, whether you like it or not, you know, to pay for that information to be provided to you. Yeah, cool. I think that's a really interesting bit. One thing, maybe I don't know if there's any more pieces, Evan. I feel like you were going to say something there, so I'll probably just shut up for a second.
Oh no, I was just going to sort of agree with yourselves on that point too. And as you say, I think the FCA will take a very dim view now of anybody that, well, certainly of applicant firms who don't have a blockchain analytics tool. But equally, that old chestnut that you come across, which is, you know, we have the blockchain analytics tool to deal with these virtual assets that these tools support. But, you know, we also support and facilitate transactions in these virtual assets, which they don't do. And we take a risk-based approach and manage and mitigate and on the rise. I think, yeah, it's probably gonna be a much harder standpoint to try and make now. But yeah, that was all.
Okay, so I think last bit that I'm sure you guys have got things that maybe you want to touch on as well, but one thing that we mentioned at the beginning was around this whole piece around missing information or information that is a mismatch, let's say, between between the counterparties involved in a crypto asset transfer. So obviously that's going to be, you know, a really big piece for firms to handle operationally, for how they actually manage this, whether it's going to be a queue format, as you've already mentioned. So there's going to have to be SLAs, policies and procedures around how this is handled and managed. So what can happen if there is missing information? Maybe we can go from there. Jason, you mentioned this earlier. Perhaps you've got some thoughts.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, if we just look kind of at the at the guidance set out in the GLMSG consultation, it's twofold, right? It's once you get that, once you receive that data, it's comparing it against your knowledge of the customer. And in any sort of material discrepancy, i.e. complete mismatch in name, mismatch in address, jurisdiction, whatever that may be, the guidance says you may sort of consider reaching out to the originator of ASP and providing them with that information as well. Obviously, you have sort of tipping off concerns and that, but the information sharing should be considered. But say in events where information's missing or there's a slight mismatch or anything like that, firms really need to have effective policies and procedures in place and management tools that allow them to either reach out to the VAS or reach out to their customer to see if they can backfill any of this information or rectify any of the discrepancies. You mentioned the queue format, Chris. You know, initiate an SLA that has been developed with your resources in mind, your technology, and kind of this training that your staff have, and sticking rigidly to those SLAs are going to be really crucial here, right? Because you don't want to lose customers because customer experience is horrible. You also don't want to miss suspicious activity because you're under pressure to review 100 in a queue and you just don't have the resources to do it. But I think what's going to be really, really important here is the quality of your requests for information, right? You know, we've seen it before. Firms have standard templates that they send out, whether it's a fiat transaction or a crypto transaction, and ask for just block standard information. I think firms have to be a little bit more dynamic with this travel rule, right? And they have to have kind of quick and efficient, you know, identification procedures of what is this? Is this a discrepancy? Or are we lacking the information? If it's a discrepancy, is it a material discrepancy, i.e. suspicious activity, therefore we escalate it? Is it a discrepancy that we can rectify with talking to the originator fast or talking to the customer? Then let's get the RFI process kicked off. And all while we're doing that, we have to make sure that funds aren't being made available until that's being rectified. Or when I say funds, obviously referring to crypto assets. It's how firms go about doing that is, you know, I hate to quote the regulations, but it has to be in reference to their nature, size, and the complexity of their business. And that's really key, right? It's something that firms have to do, essentially, is take stock of where they are and be really realistic with themselves. Don't set their standards massively high and then fall short. Have a roadmap of this is where we want to be in 6 months. This is where we are now. In 6 months' time, we want to be here. In a year's time, we want to be here with the effectiveness of our kind of RFI program, our discrepancy program, and our suspicious activity program.
I completely sort of agree with that. I feel like operational rigor is one of those things at the minute, which everybody should be focusing on, and sort of couldn't agree more. Well, you saw it with the Coinbase fine that we discussed a few podcasts ago, and how the tendency to just let business continue and, you know, let backlogs build and build and build can happen. Firms should be aware and alive and agile to the challenge that this is going to face. Bog standard template RFIs in TradFi, best will in the world, don't really work anyway, and it's definitely not going to work with a brand new requirement such as this in a pretty nascent sort of business model and so on. So yeah, firmly agree with your point, Sergius.
Indeed. And I think the other thing is, as you've mentioned there, depending on your business model, this is going to impact you completely differently. If you're a prime brokerage, for example, doing relatively low volume, high value transactions, it's probably not going to impact you as much as if you're a custodial wallet provider to consumers, you know, serving the mass market, let's say, just purely on a volume basis, because of the operational outlay. So that's worth considering, and all needs to be taken into account 100%. There's maybe one more topic I want to cover, guys, and then, you know, we can look to maybe close off. But I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention the Sunrise issue. It's afforded only one paragraph in the JMLSG consultation, which I think is probably all we'll need to cover off what we need to say about the Sunrise issue. But maybe we can define it and then we can, you know, have a couple of minutes on it.
Yeah, definitely. Like if you don't mind, Evan, I can sort of talk to what it is and then we can sort of look at it a bit more practically. Yeah, so the Sunrise issue is essentially an issue where UK firms will be receiving crypto transactions from firms that are not under the same obligations to share travel rule information. So you touched on it earlier in the podcast, Chris, where you mentioned that, you know, Europe won't have these mandatory obligations in place until Q4 2024 at the very earliest, not taking into account any sort of grace period with the introduction of MiCA and that. So the question is, what do UK firms do if they're receiving transactions from a virtual asset service provider in a jurisdiction that doesn't have travel rule obligations? They are subsequently writing out to those virtual asset service providers and requesting the originator and beneficiary information, and they're not getting any response. What are they, you know, because they're, you know, and the best will in the world, the virtual asset service provider in that region may not have have started building their program as of yet. So, you know, supplying that information could be very difficult. What do UK firms do, essentially? Do they send all transactions back at a, you know, at a quite a significant cost and customer experience impact? Or as the guidance says, will we get more sort of supervisory notice from the FCA on this point?
Yeah, I mean, the reference to take account of any FCA communications on this matter is a particularly terrifying position for the JMLSG to point us towards. I think, yeah, I mean, it's obviously a very difficult one. There would be no expectation for firms to necessarily have a approach outside of the UK, which firms in the UK themselves are struggling to sort of implement. It's going to take a bit of time. As I say, the EU looking towards the end of 2024, if I remember. So there's going to be very real challenges. You know, we're not talking about Southeast Asia or unusual jurisdictions for UK firms. The EU is not going to have this in place until next year. So like my sort of reading of it is, as ever, risk-based approach. You know, you're going to obviously have to delay allocating that transaction to the customer, potentially return a transaction or take a risk-based approach. And in essence, in my mind, you know, you'd be talking about making country-based decisions. You're probably going to want to have an assessment of the jurisdictions, perhaps starting at those jurisdictions where you have particular flow, assess the level of travel rule compliance of general equivalence with the UK, and then where possible work with these corresponding CBs where you can to try and mitigate the risk as best you can. But I think this is a very difficult one, and as JMLSG suggests, I'll be keeping an eye on the FCA for telling me what people should be doing. What do you guys think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really all there is to be said on that one, unfortunately. Watch this space, I suppose, is what we're saying on that piece. But use a risk-based approach in the meantime while we're not certain. Yeah, all makes sense. Proceed with caution. We often say that on this podcast, I think. all right, that's cool. Look, I've covered just about everything I wanted to say on this topic and discuss. And it's been really, really interesting to hear your input as well, Jason. Really valuable, super, super interesting and, you know, knowledgeable as well. So I think that's been really helpful. Is there anything that we've missed, guys? Anything that we really need to cover before we finish off this time?
I think that's maybe it for me. And I'm sure probably in a month or two, we'll be doing another podcast about this when the lay of the land is a bit clearer. Speaking personally, I'm looking forward to travel rule compliance being a component of the AML audit process, and actually really legitimately looking forward to seeing how firms across the industry take on this challenge of complying with this. So I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, nothing else from me. Jason, any closing thoughts?
No, just, yeah, thanks very much for having me on, guys. I think it's probably the salient point here is that nobody knows how it's going to look or how it's going to end up. But at the minute, it's just all sort of theory without experience. So I think in 6 months to a year's time, we'll have a much better sort of view of the industry and how the industry is adapting to these changes. But yeah, I think, as you say, Evan, it'll be really interesting to see. And I'm fairly confident you could probably do a podcast quarterly on the updates that'll come out. But yeah, just to reiterate, thank you very much for having me on, guys. I've really enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure. Cheers for coming on, Jason. And yeah, I think we'll say thanks for listening and see you next time. Cheers, Evan.
Thanks a lot, both.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Partners in FinCrime podcast. If you want to get in touch with the podcast or for more information on governance, risk and compliance related matters, please reach out on our website at fscom.co or alternatively, send us an email at partnersinfincrime@fscom.co. That's partnersinfincrime@fscom.co.